Thanks, Brother Matt. Good evening, brothers and sisters and young people. Well, tonight we come to the third and final class for this series. And as I said before, when I was asked to do some talks on the Cherubim, I thought three classes would kill it, but there you go, poor judge. So we've considered in our first class the Cherubim in the beginning, in the garden in Eden. And in the second class, we considered the Cherubim in the tabernacle. And tonight we hope to look at the Cherubim in the prophets. And as we do that, there's a principle we want to keep in mind that we mentioned in the first two classes, and that is this, that the cherubim primarily reveal the outworking of God's purpose through Christ. And I think if we can keep that principle in mind, it helps us to put everything that we read about the cherubim in its proper context. Our ambition tonight is to deal with the living creatures, as they're referred to, or the cherubim, in Ezekiel chapter 1 and 10. That's all we've got time for in one class to cover, and even that is a bit of a struggle. Why Ezekiel 1 and 10? Well, simply because in Ezekiel chapters 1 and 10, that's where the most vivid descriptions are given of the cherubim, and also it's where the cherubim are most active. So it's reasonable that that's where we should direct our interest. You know, if we were to ask Ezekiel what was the most dominant feature in the visions, in the many visions that he received, possibly his answer would be the cherubim. As we've just read, his prophecy opens with a graphic description of the cherubim. He's transported by the cherubim. He's lifted up by his hair by the cherubim, transported to Jerusalem. He sees the cherubim present when the glory departs from the temple. He sees the cherubim present when the glory comes back. And he sees the cherubim feature prominently in the house of prayer for all nations. You know, in Genesis, when we, in our first class, looked at the cherubim in the garden, we saw how the cherubim were there to keep the way. And in the tabernacle and the temple, we saw how the cherubim were representative of Christ, who was the way of life. But here, in Ezekiel chapters 1 and 10, we're going to see the cherubim are involved in God's judgments. And we ask, well, how does that work? How can it be that cherubim, who are there primarily to keep the way, to preserve life, to be also involved in destroying life? How does that work? How do we reconcile those apparently inconsistent views of the cherubim? And furthermore, why is the imagery of the cherubim used at all in God's judgments? So why are the cherubim associated with judgment? Well, it's actually a very simple reason. To preserve the way involves protecting the way. Protecting the way from being lost. Lost through indifference, neglect, and corruption. Therefore, when God acts to protect the way, he did it for the sake of mankind. You know, Cain learned that lesson with the cherubim in Eden. Cain's offering was without blood. It was a way of religion, but it was not the way. God's rejection of his offering ultimately resulted in God's rejection of him, and he was forcibly removed from the presence of the cherubim. So far as the tabernacle in the wilderness was concerned, Nadab and Abihu experimented with another way, with strange incense. And there went out fire from before Yahweh, from the presence of the cherubim, and they were destroyed. And we're going to see how in Ezekiel's day, God acted and how the cherubim were involved in executing God's judgments to preserve the way. So the cherubim are involved in protecting the way to the tree of life. There's only one way, and it's on God's terms. And those terms are, I will be sanctified in those that come nigh me. That's the way that the cherubim keep. When the way is put in jeopardy, God will act to protect it for man's sake and for his holy name's sake. So with those principles in mind, let's go to Ezekiel chapter 1. Now, as we said earlier, the prophecy begins with a vision of the cherubim. And you may have thought as we read through all of those, how many verses were there? 28 verses. Wow, there's a lot of imagery there. So rather than trying to swallow an elephant, we're going to try and break it up into sections, and hopefully that will help us to digest it more easily. So let's try and create a mental picture of what we've read about in Ezekiel chapter 1. There are what we might call three realms that are described in the chapter. Firstly, the realm in which the judgment took place. Secondly, the firmament, or the expanse, as the word really means. And thirdly, the throne. And the chapter is really structured around those realms. So verses 1 to 3 is the setting of the prophecy. Verses 4 to 12 deal with the whirlwind. And verses 22 to 25, the expanse. And then finally, the third realm is in verses 26 to 28. Now, we're told in the first few verses of the chapter the context of not only this vision that we're dealing with, but really the context of the whole book. So let's read those first few verses. Now, it came to pass in the 30th year, in the fourth month, in the fifth day of the month, as I was among the captives by the river of Kibar, that the heavens were opened and I saw visions of Elohim. In the fifth day of the month, which was the fifth year of King Jehoiachin's captivity, the word of Yahweh came expressly unto Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the river Kibar, and the hand of Yahweh was there upon him. So Ezekiel was taken to Babylon in the third captivity. We've just got a simple chart here to help you try and visualize get the context of this vision. So Ezekiel was taken captive to Babylon in what we call the third captivity. It was in 597 BC. And King Jehoiachin was also taken captive at that time. And you'll notice he's mentioned that this prophecy was in the fifth year of his captivity. So this prophecy is 5 years from that third captivity. Now, 11 years later, Nebuchadnezzar returned and brought to an end the kingdom of Judah. And in that fourth captivity, Nebuchadnezzar burned the temple, he burned the houses of the wealthy, and he basically trashed the temple and defiled it. We're told in Ezekiel 1 verse 2, we're told in Ezekiel 1 verse 2 that the vision was received in the fifth year of Jehoiachin's captivity. So the takeout is from that is basically this, that this vision which Ezekiel saw in chapter 1 was just 6 years from the end. 6 years from when the kingdom of Judah was going to be destroyed, and more importantly, the temple was going to be burned. That's what the vision was intended to convey. And the cherubim are pictured as being involved in that judgment. It was a very ominous sign, a fearful sign, a final call to Judah to repent. And when Ezekiel saw the vision, he was immobilized. He fell on the ground on his face and he couldn't move. Such was the terror of this vision. Ezekiel understood what it meant for his people. You know, it was a great privilege for Ezekiel to have received all of these visions that he did. But with it came an awesome responsibility. You see, Ezekiel was charged with taking God's message to the nation. He not only had to speak it, but he had to act it. He had to portray it to the nation. He was a sign to the nation, as Ezekiel chapter 24, verse 24 says. And brothers and sisters and young people, it wasn't pleasant what he had to portray to the nation. It was horrific. It was darkness. It was gloom. It was despair. And he had to live it out in his own personal life. He had to enact the impending siege of Jerusalem by lying on his side for over a year. He had to depict the judgments of famine, pestilence, and sword. He had to cut off his hair and to chop it into pieces, to burn it and to get it allowed to be blown away with the wind. And hardest of all, he was told that God was going to take away with a stroke the desire of his eyes, his loved one, his wife, and he wasn't to cry. And that was to be a sign to the nation that they would do likewise. Such would be the calamity that would come upon them that they wouldn't even have care for burying the dead. He was appointed as a watchman to his people, to the nation who were in captivity. And God said, Ezekiel, if you fail to give them my warnings, their blood will be on your head. It was the most unthankful job anyone could ask for. It wasn't a message the people wanted to hear. In fact, the people ridiculed him and rejected him. And for that reason, God made him strong. God said to him, I have made thy face strong against their faces, Ezekiel, thy forehead strong against their foreheads. As an adamant, harder than flint, have I made thy forehead. Fear them not, neither be dismayed at their looks, though they be a rebellious house. So what's the vision in chapter 1 all about? Well, as you may be aware, there are many different interpretations of this vision. And that difference really stems from one thing, and that is who the man on the throne is that we read about. That really determines how you interpret the rest of the chapter. And the conclusion that I've reached, brothers and sisters, is the same as what we read in Elpis Israel, that the things in this chapter, that is Ezekiel 1, taken collectively, represent the Messiah upon his throne, surrounded by his saints, and all energized and made glorious by the Spirit of God. From this it is evident that the cherubim represent the aggregate of those redeemed from the nations in their resurrected state. Now there are key reasons that I believe point to the man on the throne being Christ and the cherubim being the redeemed. Firstly, the one on the throne has the appearance, we're told, of a man. And that word, that Hebrew word rendered man, is the word Adam. That word is never used in connection with God. There are four Old Testament words rendered man. There's Adam, which is the word here. It means earthy and has reference to the origin of man. In 1 Samuel 15, verse 29, we read, the strength of Israel will not lie nor repent, for he is not a man, Adam, that he should repent. Secondly, there's the word Geba, which means a mighty man or warrior. Thirdly, there's the word Ish, which tends to refer to what a man does, a man of the field, a man of God. And that's the word that, if God is referred to as a man, the word that's used. Yahweh, we read in Exodus 15, verse 3, for example, Yahweh is a man of war. And finally, the fourth word that's rendered man in the Old Testament is Enosh, which means mankind and is derived from Enash, which means to be sick, wretched, or weak. Secondly, the one on the throne couldn't have been an angel because angels are not depicted as sitting on a throne. They're usually depicted as serving or as ministering. Secondly, the cherubic faces are the heraldry of Christ and those that have identified with him by being keepers of the way. The angels are never symbolised with cherubic faces. And finally, The throne and the four living creatures appear again in Revelation chapters 4 and 5. And there the living creatures sing to the Lamb, "Thou wast slain and hast redeemed us to God." Words which clearly identify them as being the redeemed. So having established the context and the framework of interpretation, let's now look more closely at Ezekiel chapter 1, the details. Let's begin in verse 4. "And I looked, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, a great cloud and a fire enfolding itself, and a brightness was about it, and about the midst thereof, as the colour of amber, and out of the midst of fire." So this is what he saw. "From the north appeared a whirlwind, luminous, amber in colour, with fluctuating fire that lashed out and then receded." There's no mistaking the significance of the whirlwind. It portended fiery judgment. It was frightful. It was a terrible sight. You know, Israel had witnessed God's fiery indignation upon the inhabitants of Canaan in Joshua's day. "Understand therefore this day that Yahweh thy Elohim is he which goeth over before thee. As a consuming fire he shall destroy them, and he shall bring them down before thy face, so that thou shalt drive them up and destroy them quickly." But sadly, now Israel was to be on the end of God's fiery judgments. They had been warned in Deuteronomy, "Take heed unto yourselves, lest ye forget the covenant of Yahweh your Elohim, which he made with you. For Yahweh thy God is a consuming fire, even a jealous God." And they were about, brothers and sisters and young people, to painfully experience what those words meant. And you know, God is no different today, though we may like to make him otherwise. The Apostle Paul said, "Serve God with reverence and godly fear, for our God is a consuming fire." You know, that whirlwind alone would have been enough to tell Ezekiel what was coming. A whirlwind from the north. And anything from the north always indicated the direction of God's judgments. Yet the vision included the cherubim for the reasons that we've already mentioned. We learn from verse 5 that out of the midst of the whirlwind came four living creatures. And we're also told that they moved like a flash of lightning, in other words, at great speed. Now, due to the limits of my abilities as a graphic artist, I'm only going to show one of the four, and I'm going to leave it up to your imagination to imagine that there were four, because I just can't draw four in the shape that they were, so excuse me there. They were actually arranged in a square, and when viewed from above, that's what they look like. You can see each one had four faces, and they all faced in the same direction. So wherever you see that symbol on my diagrams, you'll know that if you see one, it's really four, and that's the shape of them. Okay. So in Ezekiel chapter 10, verse 20, we get these same living creatures again, but in chapter 10, they're called cherubim. So it's one and the same thing. They're the same creatures. And perhaps the reason why the Spirit has chosen to use the word living creatures here in chapter 1 is to help us associate them with the living creatures in Revelation chapter 4. This is what we're told about the cherubim in chapter 1. Each cherub had four faces, all pointing in the same direction. Now, think about this. If you were to walk around one of the individual cherubs, what would you see? Well, you would see verse 10, "As for the likeness of their faces, they four had the face of a man, and the face of a lion on the right side, and they had the face of an ox on the left side. They four also had the face of an eagle. Now think about this. If you were to walk around the group of four, what face would you see? Well, you would see the same faces. What's that telling us? Can you see that this is a beautiful figure of perfect unity? Why? Because the individual and the body corporate are identical. It's a symbol of perfect unity. So here in symbol, we have the words of the Apostle Paul when he said, "So we, being many, are one body in Christ, and every one members of one another." This body is of one mind, of one accord. There's no schisms, there's no rivalry, there's no cliques. All of the members of this body enjoy perfect harmony and fellowship with each other and their Lord. They have all come in the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God unto a perfect man, unto the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. And only members who have come in the unity of faith can be part of this body. There's only one word, brothers and sisters and young people, to describe this body: glorious. Here the four cherubim are to be understood as one, not four, because they are representative of one body. And as we're going to see, when they moved together. They work cooperatively in harmony. Now, not only did each cherub have four faces, but they also had four wings. Verse 6, everyone had four faces and everyone had four wings. And the position of those wings is given to us in verse 11. Thus were their faces, and their wings were stretched upward. Two wings of every one were joined one to another, and two covered their body. So in other words, the two outstretched wings touched the neighbouring cherub. The wings just don't touch. We're told that they are attached. Just come over to chapter 3 and verse 13. And I heard also the noise of the wings of the living creatures that touched one another, and notice what the margin says, kissed, that kissed one another, and the noise of the wheels over against them, and a noise of a great rushing. So the Hebrew word there rendered touched has the idea of fastening up or attachment. But note, it's not the hands of the creatures that are attached, but their wings. And as we saw in the last class, the wings pertain to flight, a capability that comes from being energized by the Spirit. Therefore, wings fastened together signifies unity of the Spirit as distinct from unity of the flesh. However, the attachment between the cherubs is not just spiritual. It's emotional. The word rendered touched here has almost always rendered kiss, indicating that they are knit together in love. There's a strong love and affection between the members of this body. And if we were to use a colloquial expression, we would say that their relationship was that of best of friends. Can you imagine that? Being forever united with best friends. Not only that, there's nothing that can ever come between you. The love is unbreakable, surpassing the love of women. Mortal friendships may be broken, brothers and sisters, but these won't. The cherubim had four wings. Two were used for flight and two covered the body. And when in motion, the wings made a peculiar noise that tell us about their mission. Verse 24, chapter 1, verse 24. And when they went, I heard the noise of their wings like the noise of great waters, as the voice of the Almighty, the voice of speech, as the noise of a host. And when they stood, they let down their wings. What do these things signify? Well, there can be little doubt. This is the sound of a great multitude, drawn from all nations, executing judgment with divine authority. From Revelation 19, verse 6, we know that many waters speak of a great multitude. And from Revelation 7, verse 9, that waters refer to the multitude being drawn from all nations, peoples, and tongues. The multitude has the voice or authority of the Almighty. And that word Almighty here is the word Shaddai, which means mighty or powerful. That means that the cherubim are omnipotent, that is, all-powerful. And finally, the sound of the wings was like the noise of a host. The ESV puts it this way, a sound of tumult, like the sound of an army. So the mission of the cherubim, as evidenced by the sound of their wings, was a militant one. It was a sound of judgment. Now, this next point, brothers and sisters, I find the most lovely point about the cherubim. Two of the wings covered the body. What did that signify? Well, the clue is that when the cherubim were not on a mission, their wings were let down. So whereas the wings lifted up signified engagement in judgment, wings let down signify the opposite. They signify protection and refuge. It's indicating that God is both a sun and a shield. And the question is, in the context of judgment, who is the protection afforded to? David expressed it beautifully this way in Psalm 57. Be merciful unto me, O God. Be merciful unto me, for my soul trusteth in thee. Yea, in the shadow of thy wings will I make my refuge until these calamities be overpassed. In other words, the wings let down signified that protection would be afforded to the remnant that trusted in God in the shadow of his wings. Who were they? Come over to Ezekiel chapter 9 and verse 4 just briefly. The ones who received the protection were these spoken of in Ezekiel 9 verse 4. The ones who received the mark in the forehead. And Yahweh said unto the destroying angel, go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and set a mark upon the foreheads of the men that sigh and that cry for all the abominations that are done in the midst thereof. They're the ones that came under the protection of the shadowing wings. And they were spared when Nebuchadnezzar entered the city. So the let down wings, brothers and sisters and young people, are an assurance that Yahweh will not destroy the righteous with the wicked. Going back to chapter 1 and verse 7. It tells us about the feet of the cherubim. Their feet were straight feet, and the sole of their feet was like the sole of a calf's foot, and they sparkled like the colour of burnished brass. Why calf's feet? Well, the answer is to be found in Malachi chapter 4. Let's go there. Now, in Malachi, what we find is that there's two judgments. In chapter 3, there's the judgment of the saints, and in chapter 4, there's the judgment by the saints. And it's the second one that we're interested in chapter 4. Let's read from Malachi 4 at verse 2 and 3. So these are the redeemed that have been accepted at the judgment, and now they've got a work to do. And God tells us about that in verse 2. But unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in his wings, and ye shall go forth and grow up as calves of the stall. And ye shall tread down the wicked, for they shall be as ashes under the soles of your feet in the day that I shall do this, saith Yahweh of armies. So the feet that were the shape of calves' feet were the feet of the saints that were going to be involved in that work of judgment. The feet are straight, we're told, because the treading down is the righteous judgments of God. The righteous shall rejoice when he seeth the vengeance. He shall wash his feet in the blood of the wicked. Psalm 58, verse 10. With the cherubim, we're told in verse 13, there were coals of fire and lightning. Going back to Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 13. As for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire and like the appearance of lamps. It went up and down among the living creatures, and the fire was bright, and out of the fire went forth lightning. Now, the first question is, where was the fire? The AV version, as we have it there, gives the inference that the fire was actually on the living creatures themselves. However, the Hebraist Ginsberg holds that the Septuagint is actually more correct, and I agree with him, which says, and in the midst of the living creatures, there was an appearance as of burning coals of fire, as an appearance of lamps turning among the living creatures, and the brightness of fire, and out of the fire came forth lightning. So the idea of fire being amongst the cherubs is also supported by another scholar who you may happen to know, or pair of scholars, Kyle and DeLitch. And that rendering of, or the idea of the coals being in the midst of the cherubim rather than on the cherubim makes sense when we look at chapter 10, verses 6 and 7, where the man clothed in linen is told to go into between the cherubim and to take of the coals of fire. So it appears that the coals of fire were in the midst of the cherubim rather than on them. And the fire went up and down, and lightning went forth from them. The significance of the coals and fire then becomes apparent from chapter 10. The angel was told to take coals from the fire, which was between the wheels, and scatter them over the city of Jerusalem. It symbolized the burning of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar. So the coals of fire and lightning are figures, if you like, of the destructive power of Yahweh invested in the redeemed. Yahweh also thundered in the heavens, and the highest gave his voice, hailstones and coals of fire, yea, he sent out his arrows and scattered them. He shot out lightnings and discomfited them. It was a terrifying scene, what Ezekiel saw. The burning feet, coals of fire, the blinding lightning, the voice of a multitude like an army. The other key feature that we are presented with in chapter 1 is the wheels. There were four wheels. And we are given there the details or the attributes of those wheels. Now, it's suggested that the configuration of the wheels is as per that diagram. In other words, that each cherub had one wheel, and there was a wheel within a wheel, and they were perpendicular to one another. Now, when you think about it, when you consider those wheels carefully, it becomes apparent that they're a mechanical impossibility. For this reason, that Ezekiel said that the wheels were so high that they were fearsome. Now, if you put that in perspective, if both wheels have a huge diameter, then that means that the cherubim are very far apart as well, and the cherubim would have to be huge for their wings to be touching. So I think we have to understand there's limitations intended in the imagery when we read it. It's trying to convey moral principles, not mechanical realities. Furthermore, we're told that the wheels didn't turn, another mechanical impossibility. They didn't turn when in motion, and I take that to mean sort of angular movement rather than rotational movement. In any case, That's not the normal operation of a wheel. So what do they signify? Well, a wheel is, of course, used for movement. And in this case, as fast as a flash of lightning. And that makes the cherubim able to be anywhere, anytime, in an instant. Therefore, the wheels signify omnipresence. The wheels, we're told in verse 18, were living. They were full of eyes. Verse 18, and as for their rings, or in other words, the rims of the wheel, they were so high that they were dreadful. And their rings were full of eyes round about them four. So the rings, as we said, refer to the rims of the wheels. So the wheels made the cherubim not only omnipresent, but also omniscient, that is, all-knowing, aware of all things, perceiving all things. The eyes of Yahweh are in every place, beholding the evil and the good. And in the four cherubim, we might say that's representative of the corporate body of Christ. But in the eyes, we have represented the individual members of that body. Now, before we move on to the other realms, the expanse and the throne, we must make a comment about the motion of the cherubim. In verses 17 to 21, it goes to great length to describe the motion of the cherubim. And concerning that motion, we notice that what is said about the cherubim is also said about the wheels. You can see there, both of them went straight forward. Both of them turned not when they went. They went wherever the Spirit led. When one went, the other went. When one was lifted up, the other was lifted up. When one stood, the other stood still. So when they moved, it looked something like this. They went straight forward. When the cherubim moved, the wheels moved. When the cherubim stood, the wheels stood. When one lifted up, the other lifted up. Clearly the point being made is that the cherubim and the wheels moved in unison. The point being that the cherubim are not only one in thought, but also in action. And the reason given is in verse 21, that the Spirit was in the wheels. There was unity of spirit. So they, in other words, they act in harmony because they are all directed by the head. They work in cooperation, not competition. Because as Paul said, there is one body and one spirit. And the takeaway for us, brothers and sisters, in our present mortality is the same truth, that true unity can only come through the influence of the Spirit Word. Anything else is union but not unity. Now the remaining verses from verses 22 onwards introduce the two other realms that we saw in an earlier diagram, that is the expanse and the throne above the expanse. But these verses also introduce a new order of things, and we must interpret these two other realms in that context of this new order of things. At the end of verse 24, we are told that the cherubim stood still and put down their wings, indicating a cessation of judgment. Verses 24 and 25, and when they went, I heard the noise of their wings, like the noise of great waters, as the voice of the Almighty, the voice of speech, as the voice of a host. And when they stood, they let down their wings. And there was a voice from the firmament that was over their heads when they stood and had let down their wings. Now we know from passages such as Isaiah 65 and verse 17 that the firmament or heavens are a figure for dominion, for ruling powers. So here we have in a figure the new heavens wherein dwelleth righteousness. So what do we understand about the expanse, given that context? The context is that the wings have been let down. Judgment has ceased. and a voice issues from the heavens. Christ's rule has begun. We're told that the expanse was over the heads of the cherubim. We're actually told that five times, that the expanse was over the heads of the cherubim. What does that mean? Well, I think it's useful, we won't turn it up, but if you go to Isaiah 35 and verse 10, it says, and have I written it down? It says that everlasting joy shall be upon the heads of the saints. It's exactly the same expression. So what it's saying is that universal dominion has been bestowed upon the redeemed who are now cherubim. We're told that the colour was of terrible crystal. Now, that word colour is really the word eye. So it's saying, not so much talking about the colour, but it's saying to the eye, this expanse looked clear and the clarity was awesome. It was fearful. How does that work? Well, the clearness, which speaks of righteousness and universality of the new world order, will be awe-inspiring to the mortals. There was a voice from the firmament that was over their heads. There shall come a great voice of Christ out of the temple of heaven, from the throne, saying, "It is done. The first stage of God's work is complete." So who was this voice from heaven? Well, we believe it was Christ, and those words that were uttered from, or uttered in Revelation 16, verse 17, would have been the words that Ezekiel heard. It is done. So in other words, and to wrap up the firmament, we have depicted in the realm of the firmament worldwide peace that will ensue after the multitudinous Christ has rebuked strong nations afar off. So that brings us to the third realm, the throne above the expanse. And we're told numerous things about it. We've already considered the reasons for the one on the throne being Christ. He has the appearance of a man. And as we said, it's that Hebrew word Adam, which signifies the earthy origin of man. And as we said, there's a distinction made consistently in Scripture between the use of the word Adam and the word Ish. For example, in Psalm 62, verse 9, "Surely men, Adam, of low degree, are vanity, and men, Ish, of high degree, are a lie." There's an illustration of the sort of way in which those two words are used. The word Adam is always used in a lesser degree. So why is it used of the man on the throne? Simply because it's telling us about his origin. He is the Son of Man. He had the same origins as you and I. So after hearing the voice, Ezekiel's attention is drawn to the appearance of the throne like a sapphire stone. You might recall when Moses, Aaron, Nadab and Abihu and the 70 elders of Israel ascended Sinai, they saw the God of Israel, and there was under his feet, as it were, a paved work of a sapphire stone, and as it were, the body of heaven in his clearness. So the sapphire stone is associated with heavenliness, most likely because of its blue colour. We know the children of Israel were told to have a fringe of blue on their garments to remind them of their heavenly responsibilities. This throne is divine. It's the restored throne of David, but with an immortal king. The king has the appearance of gleaming metal and fire. Why? Because he's been refined seven times in the furnace of affliction. He's learned obedience through the things that he suffered through the trial of affliction. And the gleaming fire, the gleaming metal and fire, therefore, signify that he is fit to rule. He that ruleth over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God. Now, Ezekiel sums up all that he sees here by saying that it was the likeness of the glory of Yahweh. If we pause and ask the question, why did God use such incredible, such extraordinary imagery to describe this dominion? It's because it's like no other. It will be extraordinary. It will be nothing that the world has ever seen. The world has never seen one ruler, universal peace and righteousness. Ezekiel was stunned by what he saw, the glory, the power, the majesty of God intervening in human affairs in a way never seen before in the history of mankind. And no wonder he fell on his face. Now, the next appearance of the cherubim is in chapter 10. And as we said, the timing of chapter 1 was only 6 years from the final destruction by Nebuchadnezzar. And what happens between chapter 1 and chapter 10 is that God provides an insight into the way of life of his people that's telling us this is what precipitated the judgments of chapter 10 upon them. God pronounces in chapter 6 judgment upon the mountains of Israel for their idolatry, and in chapter 7 for their pride and violence. But the real lead-in to chapter 10 is in chapter 7, where God told Ezekiel, "Ezekiel, my temple is going to be defiled by Gentiles." That's what really forms the backdrop to chapter 10. Chapter 10 is God's preparations in anticipation of that happening. Now, to correctly interpret chapter 10, and I'm conscious of the time, we do need to pick up the story in chapter 9. Chapter 9 depicts in a vision the slaughter of the wicked of Jerusalem under the supervision of a man clothed in linen who is an angel. In preparation for the impending destruction of the temple, the glory departs from the most holy place or threshold of the temple. And we read that in verse 3. The glory of the God of Israel was gone up from the cherub whereupon he was to the threshold of the house. And he called to the man clothed with linen, which had the writer's inkhorn by his side. So verse 3, the glory goes from the most holy place to the threshold of the house. And then in chapter 10, verse 18, we read, "Then the glory of Yahweh departed from off the threshold of the house and stood above the cherubim." I told you, Matt, I was going to drink you a glass of water. So what's the point being made here? The glory of God was forced to leave the temple because it was about to be defiled by the Babylonians on account of Judah's wickedness. God held Judah responsible for the defilement of his temple. Therefore, they were going to be destroyed. On what principle? Let Paul answer. If any man defile the temple of God, him shall God destroy. So what does that mean for us, brothers and sisters and young people? For the temple of God is holy, which temple ye are. So in verses 4 to 7 of chapter 9, we read of the direction given to the angel. Let's read that quickly, verses 4 to 7. Yahweh said unto him, "Go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, set a mark upon the foreheads of the men that sigh and that cry for all the abominations that be done in the midst thereof." And to the others he said in mine hearing, "Go ye after him through the city and smite. Let not your eye spare, neither have pity. Slay utterly, old and young, both maids and little children and women, but come not near any man upon whom is the mark, and begin at my sanctuary." And in verse 11 of the chapter, the angel reports back and says, "I have done as thou hast commanded. That forms the background to chapter 10. And what connects chapter 9 and 10 is the man in linen and the transition of glory, of the glory of God. In Ezekiel chapter 1, we saw the cherubim by the river of Kibar in Babylon. In chapter 10, we have the same cherubim. We know they're the same because Ezekiel says in verse 15 of chapter 10, "And the cherubims were lifted up. This is the living creature which I saw by the river of Kibar." The features are identical except for one thing, and that is in verse 12 we're told that this creature had eyes everywhere, not just on the wheel. In chapter 1, the cherubim were involved in the judgments of the world, but now they are associated with preparing for the judgments upon Judah. And here's a chapter breakup. What we're really interested in the interest of time, is just the sections where we have text coloured. The work of the man clothed in linen that we read about in chapter 9 is not finished. He's got a work yet to do, and we read of that in Ezekiel chapter 10, verse 1 and 2. "Then I looked, and behold, in the firmament that was above the heads of the cherubims, there appeared over them, as it were, a sapphire stone, as the appearance of the likeness of a throne. And he spake unto the man clothed in linen, and said, Go in between the wheels, even under the cherub, and fill thine hand with coals of fire from between the cherubims, and scatter them over the city." Now, as we said, the coals of fire speak of the destructive power of God. So let's then ask the question, who destroyed Jerusalem? Was it the cherubim, or was it the man clothed in linen? The answer is, it was the man clothed in linen. It was the angel. So why then in this vision is he depicted as getting coals from the cherubim? If the cherubim represent Christ and the saints, how can they be present in Ezekiel's day? Well, simply this, that God was showing that the judgments outpoured on Israel were a taste of the future judgments that will be executed by Christ and the saints. It establishes a principle that those who, like Ezekiel, have kept the way and have been persecuted for doing so, to them God will give power to execute his judgments. So the imagery of chapter 10 is designed to teach moral principles, not mechanical or chronological realities. And we have a similar use of imagery in Isaiah chapter 6, where we have the man on the throne who is clearly Christ, because we're told that in John chapter 12 and verse 41, and he speaks to Isaiah. So how can Christ, who wasn't even born then, communicate with Isaiah? The point is, there are moral truths being taught without conformity to chronological correctness. So what was about to befall Jerusalem was a taste of the worldwide judgments that would be poured out by Christ and the saints in the future age. Christ and the saints will complete the judgments begun by the man clothed with linen. There's another important lesson why the cherubim feature in this judgment. Essentially, as we've seen, the cherubim represent the way to the tree of life through identification with the sacrifice of Christ. Therefore, to profane the way, as Israel did, is to profane Christ, or in a figure, to profane the cherubim. That's why the cherubim feature in these judgments. There's a moral principle at work. When the glory of God left the temple, it didn't just fly off into the sky. We're told in verse 18 that it rested on the cherubim. "Then the glory of Yahweh departed from off the threshold of the house and stood over the cherubim." That glory, in other words, brothers and sisters, is to be found in us. That glory that departed and rested on the cherubim will literally return to the house of prayer for all nations in the form of Christ and the saints. So what does all of this mean for us, brothers and sisters? We've seen the cherubim in chapter 1 and chapter 10 involved in a work of judgment, for the purpose of protecting the way. There's a lot of imagery. We can spend a lot of time working out what that imagery means and be excited by that. But we have to come away, brothers and sisters, and say, what does it really actually mean for me? What is this saying to me about God's character and about my position before him? Think about this. The coals of fire were taken from between the cherubim who represent us. In that sense, those judgments that were on Jerusalem were our judgments. We shall be called upon to continue those judgments with the man, which the man clothed in linen started. The question is, will God consider us fit for that work? There's coming a time when God will judge the world in righteousness, and he's not going to be hypocritical, brothers and sisters and young people, when he does that. He will not give the work of judging the world to a brother or sister whose way of life shows that they want to be like the world. They want to be integrated with the world. They want to be accepted by the world. He will not do that for the sake of his integrity. Who will he give that work to? He will give it to those that have the mark in their forehead, those who sigh and who cry for all the abominations that are done in the world. Does that, brothers and sisters, really describe how you and I feel about the abominations in the world? Righteous Lot, we're told, was vexed with the filthy conversation of the wicked. And the word vexed means to wear out with toil. If we're honest, we'd have to admit that the gap between our community and the world is narrowing. And it's because of a lack of leadership, an unwillingness to be watchmen, as Ezekiel was commanded in chapter 3. He was told that if he didn't call it out, their blood would be on his head. And instead of being leaders, parents are followers. They're following their children rather than leading them, allowing children to do things which ought not to be done. It was once unheard of for young Christadelphian girls to wear bikinis at an outing, for brethren to have a beer at the bar together. God's judgments came on Israel for idolatry. And it's easy, brothers and sisters, isn't it, to read those words and to think, whew, we're sweet, we're clear, we don't worship, bow down and worship idols of wood and stone. But you know, it's more fundamental than that. It's really simple. God's judgments were brought upon them because they worship more than one God. And how prevalent is that today? What is idolatry? It's worshipping more than one God. And the spirit of the world is to worship self. That's where our challenge is. There's a growing tendency amongst our community, particularly our young people, to be body conscious, to show off more of their body, to promote their body by wearing less and less. And that only shows one thing, that they've lost sight of the prize. We need to feel sorry for them, not copy them. We need brothers and sisters and young people to be watchmen, to be prepared to call it out. You know, I came out of the churches, and I can tell you that The mindset of those in the churches was simply this, that unless I do something wicked, I'll be saved. And you know, that mindset is something that is prevailing more and more in our community. Think about this. The condemnation of Noah's generation was that they ate, drank, married. Is that wicked? The prevailing mindset is, as long as we are nice to one another, that's all that matters. Christ's measure of being nice is different to man's. Christ's measure of nice will include this: let no man put a stumbling block or occasion to fall before his brother's way, for whom Christ died. The spirit of inclusion is increasing. The tendency to increase the broadness of acceptability. As the saying goes, diversity is being invited to the party. Inclusion is being asked to dance. You know, the reason why the rainbow was chosen by a certain part of our community, because it has all colours of the spectrum. Well, brothers and sisters and young people, God's only interested in one colour, and that's the colour blue. And affluence and the spirit of humanism and inclusiveness is slowly destroying our identity as the called out ones of God. We live in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. Let's not desire to be part of it. We do have a wonderful heritage and a wonderful hope. Let's not compromise our future because we don't know our roots. I'd like to close, brothers and sisters, in reading from 2 Peter chapter 3. But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in the which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. The earth also and the works that are therein shall be burned up. Seeing then that all these things shall be dissolved, what manner of persons ought ye to be in all holy way of life and godliness, looking for and hasting unto the coming of the day of God, wherein the heavens being on fire shall be dissolved, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, may we, according to his promise, look for new heavens and a new earth, wherein dwelleth righteousness.